Welcome to the IGIS Institute Sounds of Safety podcast, where our community will be delving into a series of critical issues supporting the public sector mission space. In this episode, we spotlight the real-world impact of public safety data. Our guest, Jeff Zuback, Director of Research, Analysis, and Evaluation at Maryland's Governor's Office of Crime Prevention and Policy, brings more than a decade of experience turning crime statistics into meaningful insights. He joins host Casey Rousseau to share how Maryland has reshaped its approach to data while leveraging public dashboards to engage communities and inform policy. Let's listen in to Casey and Jeff for today's episode.
Welcome, everybody. Thanks for joining us today on the IGIS Institute Sounds of Safety podcast. My name is Casey Rousseau. I'll be your host today, and I have a fantastic guest with me, Mr. Jeff Zuback. He is the Director of Research, Analysis, and Evaluation for Maryland's Governor's Office of Crime Prevention and Policy. So welcome, Jeff. We greatly appreciate you taking the time out of your schedule to share some information with us. If you wouldn't mind, take a minute or so and introduce yourself, please.
First of all, Casey, thank you for having me on here. So I'm Jeff Zuback. I've been with the Governor's Office of Crime Prevention and Policy. It's gone through a couple names over the years, but I've been with the agency combined time about 15 years leading the data and research team. I was there about 13 years, left briefly for about a year and a half, worked for the business community in Baltimore City to work on some crime reduction strategies there. And then I came back in June of 2024. I came back to the Governor's Office of Crime Prevention and Policy with a much larger data team. We're doing a lot of really exciting things, which we can talk about, a lot of our focus. So I guess I should start by providing a brief overview of what the agency does, the Governor's Office of Crime Prevention and Policy, and how data really plays a role in that. So there's kind of really three different purposes. So for one, the Governor's Office of Crime Prevention and Policy serves as the state administering agency for the state of Maryland. So what that means is that it is a grant funding agency. We provide grant funds to various public safety agencies, law enforcement agencies, state's attorneys, victim service providers, nonprofits for a variety of different purposes. At any given time, we have roughly 800 to 1,000 grants out on the street. So there's a huge data component that goes into that to make sure that we are making grant decisions based on data and research, things like that. Another component of the office is that we serve as the criminal justice policy advisor to the governor. Like I said, I've been here for three different governors now. Each governor has kind of their little different takes on how they address public safety, but we do provide a lot of data and support to help inform the governor on various public safety practices, things like that. And then the third piece, I kind of serve as a dual role as the director of the Maryland Statistical Analysis Center. I believe all states in the country have one, and it's all about the research and development component. So it's basically being that one-stop shop for various public safety data and resources for your particular state. So we provide a lot of different data and information across pretty much all facets of the criminal justice system, with the focus being, obviously, I mentioned the policy part, but really educating the public on public safety in Maryland. So I'm going to stop there. If you want to dive in the questions, Casey, that's just giving an overview of what the agency does. And then we can really dive into the data aspects of my role and how we've really transformed it over the last 5 or 6 years.
Thanks, Jeff. That was great. So yeah, today's conversation is going to focus on analytics, right? And so I was introduced to you and your team through another joint presentation that we saw at our committee. And what led to this was how impressive the work that you all were doing was. It was very easy to navigate the data that you at the state level was collecting. It was very informative, man. So I think my first question would be, is from your experience there in Maryland, how has the work you have done where these advanced dashboards, you know, in the past, it was always spreadsheets, right? You look at spreadsheets, it's very difficult to determine what it is you were looking at. Now with interactive dashboards, the layperson can really look at it and understand what's going on, not only from a state perspective, but I mean, you can really dive into local communities and cities that you all have. Can you speak a little bit about how has policy changed now that our leaders have so much great data at their fingertips?
That's a really good question. And I'll start it with the policies 1A and the general public is 1B. So getting in the policy side, you know, we've produced reports for years and years and years on legislative mandates, for a variety of different reporting areas. Like, we serve as a repository. I'm not going to name all of them, but we get data on all traffic stop data in the state. So any traffic stop where law enforcement has to use some type of discretion in order to make a traffic stop, we get that. We get law enforcement's use of SWAT teams, no-knock search warrants, their use of DNA evidence, use of facial recognition technology, seizure and forfeiture data, any death in police custody or any death while someone's in the process of being arrested, we collect that. On the jail side, we get data on restrictive housing, inmates that are placed in restrictive housing, those that are getting drug treatment for years and years and years. We produced sometimes 20, 30 page reports with this data. Somewhere there was a shift around 6 or 7 years ago where we just decided that it was too much for policymakers to really look at this data. And we started building dashboards. We kind of took a risk at that time and then realized very quickly that these dashboards were being well received because you got to the answers a lot quicker. They were very intuitive, very interactive. So I think it allowed some of the policymakers to make decisions faster. So that's part of it. And then from a general public's perspective, we can certainly elaborate more throughout the rest of this podcast, is just ways that I think we've really have taken a strong leadership role, or I guess we're leading the way in the country as far as making dashboards easily digestible for the general public. And we've gotten a lot of feedback on some of our dashboards since we've posted them, that the data is a lot more digestible. It's a lot more interesting to people. I see people quoting our stats all the time from our different dashboards. So I hope I got to the answer of your question. I think at the end of the day, it helps policy makers understand the data quicker. And as a result, decisions can be made quicker.
That's great. Expanding past policy, what type of feedback or results have you all seen from the individual agencies and courts and the entities that's producing this data? Have they been fairly receptive on, wow, okay, now we have visualization into our actual data? I hate to say it, but sometimes people hide, right? Because, you know, we'll present a picture of what's going on, but the data tells no lies. What type of response in Maryland from the local entities on, now all of this data is out there, how have they responded to it?
I'll answer this in a couple different ways. I'll do this in two parts. One is the legislative mandates. The agencies know that they have to send us the data. Because I've been with the agency for 15 years now, I feel like I've developed a really good rapport with the reporting entities, whether that's law enforcement, whether that's the local jails. And I felt like we've already gained that legitimacy that we can analyze data objectively in a non-biased manner. And I think as a result, that has made this transition a lot easier. We've told agencies we're making the data public. We send them courtesy emails all the time, sometimes quarterly emails that says, as a reminder, this next batch of data is due. Please check out our data dashboards page. All of your data is here. So I feel like that's been very receptive to people. And a lot of agencies, people get questions about their own data and they say, come to our dashboards because we lay it all out there for them. Certainly they have to validate their own data if it's coming back to them. But I feel like that's been very positive. And then I feel like we work really well with different agencies. I mean, it's on an agency by agency basis. And we always do a good point in our dashboards. You know, I can't speak for all the other ones, but if we know that there's other agencies that are producing, like maybe we have 50% of the story, they have another 50% in an area that we're not tracking, we provide links to a lot of other agencies' dashboards, knowing that we're not the only ones producing them. Pretty much all agencies are now using dashboards in some way, shape, or form. But I think we've had a good rapport. We have some data that involves some prison data. We work directly with them. We have a courts dashboard. I could probably spend 15 or 20 minutes alone just talking about our courts dashboard. So I would definitely like to save some time for that. But we did meet with the courts. We let them know that it was publicly available. We weren't blindsiding them with anything. They're producing their own dashboards, which are shown in a little bit different ways. And I think that we're trying to get in a more ongoing data sharing partnership with them. There's a little bit of time involved in that with them getting some of their data systems up to specs as far as running data. But I feel like, I don't think we've ever been to a point where we blindsided an agency where we put their data up and they didn't know about it. We always do our due diligence to talk to the agencies. We don't necessarily get their blessing, but we're like, we're making this data public. Did we interpret this data correctly? We've always done that before something's gone live. So I think that that partnership's gone really well for all the agencies that we've used so far.
So the analysis that you all are doing there, is it the same results for the agencies as it is to the public, or do you dive in deeper for agency only analytics versus what you share with the public?
That's a really good question. I mean, for the most part, the data we put in our dashboards is the data we use other than any identifiers. That's something that we've never done in any of our dashboards, is that we always analyze the data on a case basis. We only need an identifier to know that these five cases involve this one individual and these seven crimes. Like, we don't care who the individual is. We just need to know for tracking purposes that that represents that one individual. And the data that you will see on the dashboard is there were 36 individuals charged with first degree murder, you know, in this county in 2015 or whatever. But it's never meant to provide names. And we always talk with other agencies. And this is another caveat that we do, is suppression count. So if, because you know, with dashboards, you can drill down to the county, you can drill down a year, and sometimes you may get down to really low numbers. And we have various dashboards where that's the case, and we provide suppression counts. We usually go with 10, unless the agency that we're working with has other stipulations. But like, if you drill down to a certain level, it might just say number of offenders less than 10, and it just kind of sticks with that. So the intent is that we never want to use the dashboard to identify people. That's, other agencies may use their dashboards for that purpose, but that's not our intent. It's to provide trends on cases, on incidents, but never to get down to the individual level.
Great. Just curious, from the state level there in Maryland, based on the data that you're pulling in your analytics. So let's say you have a dashboard and it shows a particular type of crime in a particular geographical location. What proactive steps does the state take at all? Does the governor's office or state police engage those local areas and say, hey, we have a problem here, let's go fix it? Or do you have more of a standoff saying, look, we're telling you what's going on, but we're not actively engaging from the state to go solve it. We're going to leave that to the local departments to handle that.
That's a really good question. And this is something that we're still actively working with right now. When I left the state, I was heavily recruited back by my new executive director. And knowing that, I said, if I'm coming back, I need a larger team. And we really need to become what I consider a leader in evidence-based. I know it's the buzzword that everybody uses, evidence-based, or a data backed grant funding agency. So what that means is we're really trying to use this data, and we're still in the process of incorporating this within our grant funding structure. But we want to use this data to identify those areas that need grant funding. Maybe some of those areas that have routinely not gotten as much funding as some of the other jurisdictions or at the local level. So we're trying to find ways to use our data to drive our funding decisions. We can't necessarily tell other state agencies what to do. If those state agencies are applying for our grant funds, we can give them some direction on what they can use their grant funds for, but we can't try their policy. Now, we can provide some of this information to the governor, and the governor may be able to use some of his resources, some of his clout to help make these changes. But I think as far as the crime perspective, I think that a lot of the main agencies know where their data lies, but we're also trying to uncover new pieces of data every day where we could potentially impact policy in some way. I hope that answered your question.
But yeah, it does. And it kind of leads me to my next little topic here. Is, with your experience, I kind of just want your personal take on this. I know at our committee, which is the Advanced Analytics Committee, we're always talking about the difference between reporting and analytics, right? And we kind of always say, all right, reporting tells you what's happening. Analytics tells you why it's happening. You can start trying to dig into that. I just want your thoughts on that. When you're looking from the analysis standpoint, are you all focused on, okay, we're trying to tell you what's going on in the state, or are you have bigger aspirations to say, okay, we know what's going on, let's try to figure out the links to understand why it's happening so we can change it and alter what's happening within the state?
I think it's a combination of both. One of the things that we do with the dashboards, some of them are a little more easy to digest than others, but a lot of the times we give the end user the flexibility to use the dashboard. I don't know if this is going to be a question later down the road. I'm not off topic, but I might go on a tangent here, so just bear with me. I swear there's going to be some relevance to this in the end. Since we just put our dashboard page up about 3 months ago. We have, I think, 19 or 20 dashboards up there. We really want to come up with a system, whether it's a survey, an online poll, something to engage with the public. You know, what dashboard did you see? What are you using it for? What value did you find? What was not helpful? What would you like to see different? And use that as a way to see how they're using the data, because we don't want to necessarily provide analysis for them. We don't know what they're coming for. Are they using our crime dashboard because they're recently moving to Maryland and they want to know the safest county to live? Are they using our court dashboard to just track trends over time? Or do they specifically, are they looking to put in a bill that's changing sentence lengths for a particular offense? So we kind of leave it very interactive so that they can drill down to the level that they're using it for to come up with their own analysis. There are a few dashboards that are very robust, like the court's dashboard, which I'm sure we'll get back into more, where we actually have a more detailed dashboard that they can click on what they want. And then there are like one pagers where we kind of present what we consider some of the most significant findings so that they don't have to do a lot of clicking to get to that point. Having said that, one of the things that we're also trying to do is, and this is one of the powers of using our analytics platform or any type of business intelligence tool. We use Power BI. I'm not a salesman for Microsoft by any means. It's just the tool that we use. But one of the powers of that or any BI tool is that you can link data sets together that otherwise wouldn't be talking to one another. So that's kind of where you're getting at. Let's really identify what the areas are. Maybe one piece of data doesn't tell the whole story, but if we link that data with five or six other data sets, we can really get to the address, not just the crime, but the root causes of it. So that's something that we're still building out. So I guess the best terminology I could use for that is untapped potential. Like, we're starting to gather that data. We just haven't gotten there with it yet as far as how it's going to drive what our agency does. I drifted off and I think I got back to where you needed to go.
Great job, man. Great job. So you've mentioned it a couple of times and it's something that's pretty dear to me as well. The court dashboards and the court data. Unless you've been part of the criminal justice system, either working in it, engaged with it as you're part of a case, I would venture to say that the vast majority of the people have no idea what takes place inside of the court system. And I say court system, everyone, there's enough TV shows on live PD of watching cops and online. No one really talks about what goes on inside of our courtroom. And one of the things that I was really impressed by your dashboards is it showed adjudication, it showed prosecution, it showed some things that really made you open your eyes and want to ask questions, right? Of, okay, this type of crime we're having in this community, and this is how many of them are prosecuted, and these are adjudicated, and all of this stuff. I think the majority of the public have no clue, right? But to look at this, I think it's really powerful because now the community can ask smart questions. We hear about revolving doors in our courts and prisons. What has been the overall response to the court dashboards from not only the courts, but also the public?
So the courts, I can't say that the courts are happy that it's up there. I should preface the data. It's their data, but we didn't ask the courts for the data. There's Maryland Judiciary Case Search, which is a public database. Mainly people use it to look up people, cases, things like that at an individual level. But there were a couple companies that we worked with that were actually able to scrape all of the data behind the scenes, which had all the information that's in those cases is publicly available. But there's no way for you to just say, I want to search every case involving murder. That's not how case search works. You have to look it up on a defendant, you know, offender basis. So we got this data and very quickly realized the power of it, knowing exactly what you said, that there's different pieces of what happens in the court system, but nothing that actually tracks a case from start to finish. So we knew the power of this data. And thankfully, we got some federal funding that's only eligible to the statistical analysis centers through the Bureau of Justice Statistics. And we were able to, this probably was a 3-year project because it involved a lot of cleaning of court data. Data systems at that time were not unified, so it involved merging like 5-6 different data sets together. We're talking about, you know, 50, 60, 70 million records in here, so a lot of data to work with. And we translated that and really tried to capture the ways that we thought it would be useful. We know the general public's found it very useful because, like you're saying, it's a new piece of data that's never been seen before. The state's attorneys love it. I presented it to them once, and I'm presenting at their state conference in a couple months as well, because they tried to put in legislation that required the state's attorneys to report information on their cases. And they saw it and they're like, oh my God, this has 90% of what the legislature wants. You already have it in one clean place. We love this transparency. So I know that they love it. All agencies that I've seen, I think some people honestly are overwhelmed by it because there is so much information that's there. But everybody that we've seen has really talked about how valuable it is. And we really customize it because this gets back to what I consider our dashboards. I think at the end of the day, the general public is probably our most important constituent when it comes to dashboards. We need to make the dashboard so that the general public understands it. If they understand it, then anybody else can. But we build out the court's dashboard so the general public could look at any crime. We also have all of the criminal code information. So if a lawyer wants to come in and look at a particular statute or criminal code, it's available. You can see the totality, not just so from start to finish, you can see how many total cases there were, how many did they move forward with a prosecution, how many did they move forward with a conviction, and if there was a conviction, did they actually get sentenced? And by sentence, what we mean is we factor in, like if someone got 10 years, all 10 years suspended, we're not counting that as a sentence to incarceration. We're counting anything that got at least one day incarceration, what that looks like. And then we're also capturing the totality of all the charges in a case. So someone may get charged with murder, they get charged with 20 things, but they end up getting a conviction for firearm possession. We would have the data on everything associated with that case, all of the charges associated with it. Another piece of data that we have that we haven't done much with it, but again, it captures the totality of a court case, is the pretrial data. So before their case is even brought forward, we have data that looks at every single person that is arrested and basically brought before. There's a two hearing process in Maryland. Someone's arrested, they go before a district court commissioner within 24 hours. And then the next business day, they go before a district court judge. So the court commissioner can decide, are we going to hold you? Or are we going to release you? If they're held over, they then go before a district court judge next business day. So we have all the data that tracks the outcomes of all of those cases. Are people getting released? Are they staying? Are they getting bail amounts? How much are the bail amounts? Things like that. So it's really tracking the totality of a case from start to finish. I mean, there are some limitations to it. The data is not perfect. No data is. You find a perfect data set that doesn't need to be cleaned and I'll be out of a job. So
yeah, I hear you, man. I guess something that's on my mind is, now that you have all of this data and these dashboards that clearly show that, have you heard any from the state Supreme Court about using your data for judicial review to look at what judges are doing, how they're managing their cases, to see, okay, we've got these judges that grossly waive charges or whatever in their courtrooms that normally you would have to go case by case in paper to try to put that data together. Well, now you've got a clear dashboard that shows this is what's happening. Are you aware? Is the upper courts using this for judicial review?
Well, our data, and I preface again, our data, including defendant information, our dashboard does not include any defendant information. It does not include any judge information. So you can look at the data by county and see, are there certain counties that don't prosecute as heavily or get lower conviction rates or sentence for less time on certain offenses? But our dashboard was not meant for that purpose. I know the courts would have that data, but the thing that you're bringing up, and I think our agency really plays a role, is other agencies may have their data. We just may display that data in a little bit different way that we think is more valuable for the general public. But yeah, it's never been used for judicial review for our data. I feel like that's the judiciary's responsibility for their own data, if that's the case. But that was not the intent of this project. Other people may have that motivation, but that was not the motivation behind our project.
No, I get it. I was just wondering that because of your ability to scrape that data and do really good things with it, to me, it gives the opportunity for a level of accountability that was just never possible before, right?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Because, I mean, the state attorneys and the DAs, they could use it for the same thing, right? Yeah. Like they can really get a bird's eye view of what's going on from their prosecutors of how they're operating.
It doesn't provide a complete story. Like in our dashboard, I can tell you right now which counties have the lowest prosecution rates, but it doesn't get into why was a case dropped. I mean, we all know why cases get dropped, but that is not in our data. So we might have some resources for grant funds. Like I know one of the number one reasons why a case is dropped is that the victim may fail to come forward. And I know that our office gives out victim witness relocation funds. So I know that that's an area where we know that we can make an impact on that particular stat, but that's not actually in our court's dashboard.
Let me ask you, is any of your dashboards now, have y'all gotten to where you get charges that come in from law enforcement, right, on a case? But then very often those charges are amended once it gets to the district attorneys, the prosecutors, then to what someone is actually acquitted or convicted of or adjudicated at the very end. That in charge could be vastly different than what the charge was on the front. Are you all tracking that as well, how those charges change over the course of a case or not?
So that's a good question. And I should preface too, one of the limitations of our court's dashboard is that it's not real time. This was a static data set that we got. There's some complications why that is. If we have more time, I can explain that. It mainly goes through the expungement and shielding laws that took place in Maryland. But so I guess we can walk through a case study. We would know every single charge that someone's charged with, regardless of what happens at each individual charge. So you get a first-degree murder case. The person is charged with first-degree murder, second-degree murder, manslaughter, gun possession, use of gun in a violent crime, and armed robbery. We would have data on those 7 or 8 charges. So we would have the same case number. We would have all 8 of those charges. We could then track what happened to all of those charges. So if you did a search for murder, like if you drill down our dashboard to first-degree murder, you would see all accompanying charges that associated with murder. So you're going to see how long people are actually getting for first degree murder for the actual charge as well as the case. And in that case, you may see the number go down. It could also be higher because if someone gets 2 convictions in a murder case, we're going to add the sentence length for both of those convictions together. But we're also going to be tracking that first degree assault. If they null prost, not prosecuted, dismissed the charges for murder, but they got a conviction of first degree assault, armed robbery, whatever, we're going to be tracking that. So you have the ability to search it at the case level and the charge level. It's very intuitive in that way. So we all know law enforcement tend to overcharge. We know that, and you can see that in the data. I think the average case in our dashboard, I think there was an average of like 8 or 9 charges per case. And they may only end up with 1 conviction. They may not get convicted at all, but you know, they might end up with 1, 2 convictions of those 9 charges. So,
gotcha. And this is a curiosity question. In Maryland, if officers run, let's say, criminal history on someone in Maryland, do y'all disclose and show, all right, this is what they were arrested on, this is what they were actually charged by the DA with, this is what they were adjudicated? Is all of that shown in Maryland, or do y'all just say, hey, this was the arrest report, this is what they were arrested on? We got no idea if it was upcharged, if they were adjudicated. What do y'all do in Maryland with that?
So that's a really good question. And I should preface, I don't know all the behind the scenes because we are not a criminal justice agency. We don't have access to that criminal history information. I will say that the court system and the criminal history system are 2 separate systems. Criminal history is managed by the Department of Public Safety and Correctional Services. So that would happen, and I'm sure that's the same in every state, but that is triggered by a fingerprint. So someone is arrested, they're fingerprinted, that data shows up as a criminal history. Then once that case becomes a court record, then that data shows up in the courts. Whether or not there's a really succinct way to link those cases together, there's a name and probably a SID number, which is the state identification number, which we don't have access to that. That is the data that would probably be able to link this John Doe that was arrested for assault, is fingerprinted for assault. He now has a court case for that assault. That's probably at that point where you can link those cases together. But we don't deal much with criminal history data. If we do, we have to go through like an IRB process with the particular agency. So again, our data is mainly not down to that level. So I wish I had more information for you because we're not a law enforcement agency. I can't see what they're seeing. So
I was just taking a shot in the dark.
Yeah.
So tell me this, let's move into 2 sections. We'll start with one where are the gaps today that you see, all right, this is what we're missing and what would really be beneficial to what you don't have? Let's start there. Where are the gaps today? What things that you don't have or need that you don't have access to? Very much? Anything? A bunch?
I'm trying to think of this kind of like when you're rooting for a sports team. Do you root with what your brain is saying, what is smart to do, or do you root with your heart? Like if I'm rooting for my heart, I want everything. But I'm trying to be realistic about what we can get. I mean, in a perfect world, I would love, this is my pie in the sky view, and then I'll talk about more realistic approaches. But if we were able to, across all the different systems, even before someone's arrested, they're arrested by law enforcement, they get charged, you find out what happens in the court, you find out what happens after they leave the prison, I would love one piece of data or one system that would track all of that information from start to finish. Now, that's pie in the sky. I know that that's not feasible per se. So what I'm looking at, we have a good handle on recidivism at the state level. So at the state prison system, we don't have a good handle on recidivism at the local level. So those individuals that might keep recycling through, you know, a jail 6-7 times in a year, there's usually some type of link to substance abuse or mental illness. So that's something that we're really trying to expand on, knowing that that's a whole, you think it's hard to get criminal history data. It's even harder to get any type of medical data. So that's certainly an area. We're really trying to expand on our data on diversion. So people that don't even get processed through the criminal justice system. So those are kind of some gap areas. Another project we're really delving into now is, you know, the adult system's complicated. The juvenile system is about 5 times more complicated. We're gathering data right now that's really tracking all the decision points at the juvenile level, because there's a lot more involved in youth and youth that don't ever actually get charged. And youth that do get charged, sometimes as an adult, sometimes not. So we're tracking that. That's another gap. I mean, I could go on all day about, I want data for every little thing, but, and I'd love to get crime data. And this is not a problem just for us. There's very few states that have crime data down to the address or zip code level. We're working with an agency right now, a company that's able to get data down to the census tract, even the census block. Like the census block is probably too deep for us, but there's like 1,300 census tracts in Maryland. So we're about to get data down to that level. But I'd love to be able to get data down to that address level, not for the sake of us. Again, our purpose is not to identify particular addresses. But if we got that data down to the address level, we could drill it out to any level of detail we want, whether that's block, zip code, city, or whatever. And then we could really drive a lot of our grant funding towards those underserved areas. Because if we're looking at municipality data, like, yeah, Maryland has 100, 110 municipalities. But if you look at a municipality map, it only covers probably 25% of the state. Like some of our largest counties, you know, Baltimore County doesn't have any municipalities. So unless, thankfully, they have an open data portal, so they have a lot of their crime data public, but they don't have any municipalities. So if we're looking at general UCR data, or now the conversion to NIBRS data, we can only see crime in Baltimore County. We can't see crime in all of the underlying areas associated with Baltimore County unless those agencies make their data publicly available. So I hope that got to what you were looking for.
It did. Thank you. I thought I had one more thing, but I got two. Tell me about, you mentioned a couple of times grant funding. The grants that are available, what are they used for? Or is it used for them to hire an analyst to get y'all the data to make the connections? What are the grants available for that you're talking about?
That's a really good question. And I'm doing a very high level overview. I'm not a grants expert in the office, but we have, like, among our 800 to 1000 grants, we have about 65 different grant programs. Some of them come from federal funds. Some come from state funds. Some are legislatively mandated. Some we have discretion to do what we want with it. Some is not. Like, probably 40% of our funding comes from SAP. Sorry, I'm using acronyms in the government world, State Aid for Police Protection. So that's money that goes out to all the law enforcement agencies. That is formula driven. We have really no discretion over what that money is used for, but we have a lot of money that goes to crime victim service providers. They do that to serve crime victims. Sometimes they specialize in certain areas. We have certain funds that are dedicated just for domestic violence victims, sexual assault victims, things like that. A lot of our law enforcement grants, there's so many different ones. There's some that we fund for them to disrupt and dismantle criminal organizations. We have funding for them to to really investigate firearms trafficking and seize guns. We have other ones that's like a pass-through body armor grant that gives them body armor and equipment. We have ones for police recruitment and retention for them to do initiatives. We have accountability.
So more specifically, in Maryland, are there grant funds specifically for analytics that helps your job? Like to say where agencies say, look, I don't have time to do all this analytics stuff. Well, there's money for you to at least put a program to get the data to the right people so they can do the analysis. Are there grant funds to help your initiative as far as getting the data?
That's a good question. So we have a separate grant and it's funded by the Bureau of Justice Statistics that just funds our unit. You know, it maybe covers one or two positions to carry out data and research projects. Any other type of data or research, we wouldn't necessarily be the applicant. We couldn't be the applicant, but we could fund other agencies to do data and research. But that's primarily funded. I'm sure everyone knows what Burn JAG is, or Burn Justice Assistant Grant. That's kind of that grant that has a lot of different purpose areas. That's kind of the area where if there are any data initiatives, they're most likely funded under there. But we're not getting extra support for my team other than like what's already in the state's budget or what we're getting federal funding for from the Bureau of Justice Statistics.
So on that, a percentage would be great if you know it. I'm thinking about any state that is nowhere close to what you guys are doing, that are trying to figure out, wow, this would be really great to do. Of your team, what percentage of that is funded by grants versus the state has to figure out funding for? Do you know?
Probably 20% is grant funded. The rest is in the state budget. Actually, no, because we have some other grants. I have a couple of people that are funded by Bureau of Justice Statistics. I have an analyst that's funded through Justice Reinvestment Act legislation. I have another one that's funded through like a combination of Burn JAG and what's called Burn Skip. So it varies. It's probably a 50-50 split. But if you're giving me like advice, if someone else is trying to build what my team has put together, first you need to invest the time. You know, I love Power BI. That's because I've used it for so long. But I mean, I've been using it since 2017, 2018, before dashboards were like, you know, people were using them, but it wasn't like a national phenomenon that you see now. So you really need the time to learn whatever tool it is, whether it's Power BI, Click, Tableau, whatever solution you want to use, is really learn it. And there's always good discussion groups online, YouTube videos, whatever you need to do to just learn it. And you really need to learn the ins and outs of your data infrastructure so that you can start to build that out. And then if you have a good team of analysts, I mean, you could really put out good work with a team of three or four, depending upon the time. And I'm speaking for me, but I know some agencies have really insane data sets, or they're still using PDFs or handwritten notes, or, you know, whatever. And so I can't speak for all the different records management systems or case management systems that people have. But
got it. Great. Last question I have for you is, it's on everybody's mind, so I always like to ask it. In your world, what role do you see AI playing today in 3-5 years in the future?
That's a really good question. I kind of had a feeling this was coming. I mean, we all know AI is here, and I know that there are some AI capabilities within Power BI that we've seen. We haven't really explored that arena. So I feel like, I guess I want to toot my horn and my team's horns, and I think that there's a certain level of creativity that goes in this, like bridging the gap between really complicated data and understanding that data for policymakers, that I feel like AI is not there yet. Now, maybe it will get there, but I feel like that there's a niche here where AI can't necessarily replace the work that we're doing. I don't know. I hope I'm right anyway, because I love doing this. I would hate for AI to be able to replace the work that we're doing on these things, but.
Yep, I get it. So cool. We're at our 45 minutes. Jeff, I want to thank you, man. I greatly appreciate you taking the time and sharing it. I'd love to do this again and go into some different areas. If you want, would you like to share with everyone where they can find your work?
Is there a way in your podcast or on the website that you could provide a direct link to?
Yeah, I'll tell you what we're going to do. When we post this online, we'll put a link to your sites. Either we have that or we'll get that from you and we'll put it. So everyone who's listening, if you just go to the details of wherever you're listening to this at, they'll have a link to Jeff and them site. I urge everyone to go check it out. It's phenomenal. They're doing some really cool work and it'll give you an idea of kind of what's possible at the state level. It's fantastic.
Yeah, if you go to, so if you just Google the Governor's Office of Crime Prevention and Policy, you go to our webpage on the left-hand side, there's a quick link section, click public safety data, that has kind of the landing page of all of our dashboards, and they're sorted by theme. So like right at the top is our crime dashboard, which allows you to compare any city in Maryland, any county in Maryland. We also have a state one, so you can compare all 50 states across all the crime metrics. We're also in the process of adding a city dashboard, so you can compare any city in the country that you're interested in. And then the next topic we have is law enforcement. So we have a lot of different dashboards under law enforcement, DNA evidence collection, deaths in custody, SWAT team deployments, traffic stops, use of force data. Then we have a youth justice section, which really looks at adverse childhood experiences and juveniles charged as adults. We have a section on corrections, so that's going to look at our local jail population, restrictive housing data, and opioid use treatment in jails. Then we have a court section, so that's that court dashboard that we were talking about. We also did a deeper dive into just human trafficking-related court cases and victim information. And then we have a behavioral health section that we're also looking to beef up a little bit with some of our projects. So you can see all the dashboards there, and we have some coming soon placeholders, so you can continue to check us out at any time. I like to at least once a month have a cool new dashboard up. In the next 2 weeks, we're going to be posting a law enforcement employee dashboard that's going to have sworn law enforcement data for all 18,000 law enforcement agencies in the country, and then also a more deep dive into Maryland and some of the recruitment and training and academy practices that the law enforcement have. So we're trying to routinely, at least monthly, adding to this to really beef up our toolkit for the public.
That's awesome, man. Again, great job. I love your enthusiasm and the effort that y'all have put in. I think it's phenomenal information that the public really needs to know about with it. So again, thank you for your time, brother. Have a great weekend, and we will talk again soon.
You too, Casey. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for tuning into today's episode of the Sounds of Safety podcast. Be sure to stay connected with the IJIS Institute on LinkedIn and X, and don't forget to subscribe on Apple Music, Spotify, or your preferred podcast platform to catch future episodes. From cybersecurity to artificial intelligence and deep dives into critical national data sharing initiatives, the Sounds of Safety podcast has you covered. Until next time.